listening and welcome to episode 53 of the Deck Tease podcast brought to you by LegitMTG.com. I am Erin Campbell. From doing this show and getting the names that I've managed to get lately, people always wonder who's the hardest to get on the show, who's the biggest diva, how much trouble did I have to go through? And you would think the likely suspects like John Finkel, Brian Kibler, Jackie Lee, you would think that they'd be really hard to get on the show. And actually, they were a breeze compared to tonight's guest. You may know him directly from the Mothership or because he's freaking adorable. Gavin Verhey.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
How's it cooking?
You are a handful, sir.
That's what I'm doing.
A little bit of trouble getting you here, but I am sure that you are worth all of the effort.
I sure hope so. I'll let the viewer be the judge of that, or I guess the viewer. Unless you're looking at a blank screen right now, you're not really much of a viewer. So if you're doing that, I really recommend closing your eyes. It's going to be a way better experience for you as you listen to our sensual voices for the next hour.
Well, you did turn your webcam on for like a second, and I was really excited, and then you took it away. So now I'm just staring at my Gmail page.
You're not supposed to tell people that. Jeez. That's our little secret.
I'm already letting out secrets of WotC. Jeez.
No.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We've been trying to set this up for a really long time, and I'm really glad that we've been able to make it happen.
Yeah, me too. I'm super excited. We've known each other for a while now. We talked almost a year ago, kind of when you were when you were starting to get into Magic a little bit.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to hang out with you at Gen Con, and to this day, I still kick myself for turning it down.
Well, it's okay. We all make mistakes. I know I'm pretty awesome. So.
Are you going to be at Gen Con this year?
I am going to be there. I'll see you there.
Okay. Yes. I'll have to write that wrong. I think it was a true dungeon that I passed on doing with you.
Yeah. We'll figure out something fun to do together. Go out to dinner or something. I mean, there's Gen Con's 4 days long. Yeah. There's four dinners. I'm sure we can do at least one together.
Well, I'm actually a pretty good cleric. So if you do go back to true dungeon and you need a healer, I'm your girl.
I wouldn't picture you as a cleric, but I could totally buy that now that you mentioned it.
Well, I was a priest in World of Warcraft, so I have, like, the healing gene in me. And then cleric was the one that had the little beads where you had to, like, memorize what each bead did. So, like, one bead was beauty and one bead was life. And if you had to, like, heal damage, they would hand you a random bead and be like, name this bead. And I think I got all but one right. So I was healing everybody. So.
Do you find that your memory is pretty good?
It was, but I was also really good at like word associations. So, like for example, the beauty bead had like curls on it, and I would be like, okay, beauty, curls, curly hair, beautiful, beauty, and I would sort of like, you know, string words together to like lead to that final word. You know what I mean?
See, I always find how people think so fascinating and how they associate things together, because as gamers, we all have our own little shortcuts we take in our mind, right? We all kind of chunk things together.
Yeah.
And I find it fascinating when you're playing games, like how you can remember certain things.
Yeah. So it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't the bead itself that I would look at. It would be like more the texture, the feeling, the shape. And then I would just sort of draw the parallels there to get what I needed. So I'm your girl if you need a healer. Remember that.
Duly noted.
Cool. So let's get started. So you are 23 years old. And you are a developer for Wizards of the Coast. I was working at an adult bookstore when I was 23 years old to make ends meet. How did you get here?
How did I get here? Well, it's a long story, but the short version is I kind of always wanted to do this. Ever since I was a little kid, when I was 10 years old, I wanted to come work at Wizards of the Coast.
Okay.
And so I lived in Seattle, and it was an attainable dream. Up until then, I wanted to be a baseball player. That was a little less attainable. I mean, I thought I could do it. You know, as cheesy as it sounds, kids, I'm going to be the mom for a second and say that, you know, if you set your mind to anything, you can accomplish it, except for jetpacks. Those things are hard, man. Anyway, so I'll tell the story. I've told it a bunch of times, but it's one of my favorite stories because it's so central to who I am. When I was 11, I went to a local tournament. And it was a pre-release, and so there were a lot of Wizards people spell-slinging there. Mm-hmm. And Randy Bueller was there. And at the time, Randy was the head of R&D. Or director of R&D. And so I was 11 years old, and I go up to him, and I'm like, hey, Randy, I want to work in R&D. What do I need to do? And he looks at me. He's very serious. He's like, this 11-year-old kid is asking him this ridiculous question, but he answers it anyway. He's like, all right, kid, look, here's the deal. You need two things. The first is a college degree. And I'm like, crap, I'm never going to get one of those. That's like a million years away. Just not going to happen. And then the second one is he says, you have to be a pro player so we know that we can recognize you. And, you know, we can know to hire you on. And I was like, well, I don't know about this college degree thing, but a pro player, how hard could that possibly be? So turns out it's exactly the opposite for all the people following at home. but so ever since that moment, I just tried to play the best Magic I could. And build myself up by writing articles, by doing well in tournaments, by networking and meeting people. And eventually it all kind of, through all the things I did, through all the podcasts and all the writing and all the commentary I did, I got to where I am today. And I'm super happy that I'm here. I mean, I love it. I mean, I've been working here for almost 2 years now, and every day I come in, I'm still excited. I'm working on something fresh and new and interesting. And I've got to put my fingers in so many pies that I've had to start using my toes. There's a lot to do.
One of the things I've always found really interesting from talking to people who work at Wizards is the fact that you guys are never sick of it. You're never sick of Magic. Like, you know, it's not like some jobs where it's like you're surrounded by it all day and then you go home and you're like, God, you know, I've been designing and testing and developing and I just don't want to look at a card right now. I just don't. But, you know, the people that I know, they go home and they go to cube parties and they go home or they go to Card Kingdom and they draft and it's just such a part of their lives. And I'm always amazed at how, you know, they're just not sick of it yet. Because even with what I do, you know, with me just being a podcaster and even just playing the game, there are times where if I'm going like 3 days in a row playing, I don't want to look at a Magic card. So, you know, what do you think it is that keeps you guys so interested and not sick of it like that?
I think it's just a total passion for the game. You're absolutely right. Like I have a lot of nights where I'll be at work all day. I'll leave work, go straight to a cube draft, cube until midnight, go home and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people I'll tell that to, and they're like, how do you do that? And I'm like, I don't know. How do you breathe air? I just really enjoy it. It's just so much fun because I have this passion for Magic. It might be because I started so young too. Like I started when I was 10, right? Mm-hmm. So it's always been part of my life. And the way I'd kind of describe it is not like we grew up together. It's like we grew in together. You know, like we're Ivy wrapping around the tress, and like now we're just part of the same unit. We're just so unified.
Sure.
And obviously I do a lot of other things too. I don't just play Magic all the time. I only like to try and, you know, do my full Magic days maybe once a week. But I think a balance is important, because I think if I did just do Magic, you know, all day, every day, I would get sick of it eventually. But doing the fun parts of Magic that I really enjoy and then balancing that with the rest of my life is important to me.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that helps you with what you do, that you have such passion for it? Or do you think that if you knew when to put it down, that it would affect your work in any kind of way? Like, how does that affect what you do?
Well, I think it's definitely a double-edged sword, mm-hmm. because often you're best at something when you can take a tiny, like when you can remove yourself from it a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, if like you're doing something for a long time, maybe you just take like a slight break and you think about things for a little while and come back to it, you're really good. But at the same time, I feel like having a passion, even though stepping away is useful, having a passion just is so much more powerful than anything else, because you care about it. When you care about something, you will put your all into it. You will invest time and energy that you will never do if you don't have that kind of drive. Mm-hmm. Non-passions will fade over time, but if it's truly your passion, you'll stick with it. And that's kind of how I feel right now. Granted, you know, I'm 2 years in, maybe in 8 more years, I'll say something different, but I love it right now, and I can't see it being anything else than pure love.
Is it possible to care too much?
Is it possible to care too much? I think the dangerous side of caring is when you start caring about what you've done as opposed to what's good for the game. Mm-hmm. Like a common thing you'll hear about in game design is an idea gets pushed through because someone really loves their idea as opposed to being what's good for the game. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of good to keep that always in balance, because if I just want my cards to get made, I can just push for my cards all the time. But I have to have the discipline when I submit a card and look at a list to be like, oh, this other guy's card was better, we should use that. Mm-hmm. And so it is kind of dangerous if you get invested and you love what you do too much as opposed to loving the thing. It's important to separate those two.
Do you think that it also helps to sort of have that balance when you're hearing criticism? You know, like if it's something you're so passionate about and you, you know, I one of the things I always hear is, you know, you can hear 100 compliments, but you hear one, you know, critical piece of feedback and it can make everything fall down. And if you care too much, you might be more sensitive to that. Would you agree with that?
You know, it's funny you say that, actually, because I have heard that sentiment before, but for me, it's actually entirely the opposite.
Really?
I can hear, like, 1,000 negative things. Well, maybe not 1,000, but that'd be it. But, like, you know, if I write an article, and this has happened to me before, because back when I was writing for Star City, I used to get a pretty big mix of, wrote some controversial articles or articles that were about my life, and some people loved them, some people hated them, and those were directly about my life. I mean, that's not me as a Magic player. That is me as a human being with DNA.
Sure.
And it's, you know, when you write a really personal article about like a relationship or something, and like a bunch of people comment on it saying that they hated it, like that could sting. But the good comments always make it worth it to me. It's like there are people out there who I know I'm affecting. Someone out there across the country that I've never met in my life is being touched by something I wrote. And to me, that is incredible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we.
And as a writer, that's all I can ask for, I guess.
Yeah. Now, we talked a little bit about what led to you getting here where you are now. And you did mention some of your other endeavors. You wrote for Star City. You hosted Monday Night Magic for a time. I didn't know any of these things about you prior to researching you. And you've indicated that these things were factors in terms of you getting hired. So would you recommend that for other people? Like, let's say there are other people who maybe want to get their feet in the door. Do you think that that's a good path for others to follow?
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the people we've been hiring a lot in past years, a lot of the community involvement is important for us because we want to, like, for example, when you're writing an article, every single week you're showing that A, you don't get burned out, and B, you can keep talking about magic, and C, you can analyze things over and over and over again. I wrote that column for Star City for, I think it was almost 3 years, maybe even longer than that. I don't know off the top of my head, but every week I would go back and I would talk about something related to magic, and that constant analysis is so important when you're inside the building because you always have to be thinking about how you're approaching things. So, I think those things are incredibly helpful, and we do look at a lot of community leaders for positions. And plus, I also feel like being in touch with the community is really important because the community, at the end of the day, that is magic. I mean, people who are playing magic, the magic players, are who we're making the game for. So that's something, for example, Mark Rosewater is really good at. He'll come to us all the time and be like, I was listening to what the community is saying in all these different mediums, and I've kind of distilled it down to this essence, and I think we should do this thing. And that kind of talent is extraordinarily valuable to have.
The only thing that I would maybe caution against, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Gavin, is the people doing it just to do it, where I think that should sort of be the second reason why they blog or why they podcast. Like I would worry about somebody who's like, I'm only blogging so Wizards notice me. I'm only blogging so I can get this job someday. And then they're doing it, just to get the attention for it. I think that they should do it because they want to, number one, and then number two, because it might come in handy at getting hired. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I 100% agree with
Okay.
that. I mean, I think this goes back to the passion thing.
Yeah.
Like, you have to do something you love. And I also, I mean, maybe that I'm just making up nonsense out of the ether, and this isn't actually
Are you
true,
an
because
Aetherling?
let me tell you about Aether. That fifth toughness is mighty powerful.
Oh.
I don't know where I was going with that. Anyway, the important part here, the kids, to remember is that I'm an Aetherling. But actually, no, I feel like this goes back to being passionate. And something, when I read something that somebody wrote, I feel like if they're more passionate about it, I can kind of see that. And when you're doing something week after week, when you're working on a project week after week, you can kind of see the passion. I think a lot of people who aren't as passionate, just they get burned out faster, or they do it for a little while and realize it isn't for them. Where I'm a writer and I love magic, so that was a huge cross section for me of two things that I loved doing. And like when I was in college and I was writing. I started college at 16, so I was
16.
writing. I started college 2 years early at 16,
Wow.
and so I was writing my magic articles and I was writing my like college essays at the same time. And I would finish my college essay, and writing my magic article would be the treat that I looked forward to because I loved writing those articles. And I think if you look at it as work, you're just going to get crushed over time by the weight of it all.
Now, your official title, from what I can tell, is you are listed as being a developer. What exactly does a developer do? Because that seems like a pretty broad term.
So it's kind of weird. My official title is a designer,
Okay.
because everyone in R&D is a designer,
Okay.
but on the designer half, I'm a developer, which makes no sense at all.
Can you explain
But
what the difference is?
I'll explain what the
Okay.
difference is. So we're all designers because we just need a general term. We used to be called designers and developers by job title, but since the advent of the internet and people programming and all that kind of stuff, developer now means something very different than it used to. Developer now is a coding position.
Okay.
So we kind of made up designer, but inside designers, there's designers and developers. Designers make the worlds. They populate them with cards. They kind of create the vision, and they create the groundwork for the vision. If you can imagine a book, let's say they make a paint by a paint inside the lines book,
Okay.
and they kind of fill it up, and they give the structure for everything.
Okay, so let me
But then
see if
it's
I
the
follow along here. So you're saying that a designer, like let's say you decide that you want to go to Innistrad. So you're saying that the designer would choose Innistrad, create the setting of Innistrad, and then the developer would maybe make the cards to fill up the world of Innistrad?
Well, so I guess let's use an example. Let's use, I guess, Ravnica is a bad example because it already existed. But so yeah, let's say Innistrad.
Sure.
So you're going to Innistrad, and we have a top-down, a top-level vision. That's the first thing you walk in with, and that's we're gonna do a Victorian horror setting. That's all we know. So then the designers work with that and make it mechanics, for example. They make up the werewolf mechanic. That's like, you know, it's okay, this is going to be something interesting and exciting that's going to happen in this Victorian world. We're going to have flashback because it matters with the graveyard. Because graveyard seems so cool in Victorian, we're going to do a graveyard theme. So they come up with all these themes. Then they populate the set with cards of their design. But a lot of designers aren't pro-level players, and that's where the developers come in.
Okay.
So after the designers have finished kind of filling the file with basic ideas, the developers come in and tune everything. So they're like, that card's too strong. It needs to cost one mana less. Or this needs to be a 4/3. Or sometimes there's this deck that's tearing up the metagame. We need to put an answer in here for this.
Okay.
Or something like that. So the developers are kind of the tweakers. They shift all the knobs until they're correct. Where the designers are more big picture,
okay.
If that makes sense.
So it sounds like a developer is more like a QA person.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. I mean, we do a lot more than just QA.
Okay.
In reality, developers do end up making a reasonable amount of cards, but we keep the design vision throughout. The other thing I should note, because I might have misspoke a little earlier, is that the world is created by creative. Creative creates the worlds, but we have the top-down vision. So, like, design will come in and say, we want to do a horror world, a Victorian horror world. And then, so they have this top-down vision of, like, you know, what it's going to be. But creative is one that really brings it to life and, you know, creates all the places and the locations and maybe the races on the plane.
More the Vorthos things.
Right, yeah, creative is totally the Vorthos angle. So it's the combination, really, of design, development, and creative in tandem that has allowed us to create such awesome sets recently. And I mean, it seems weird for me to say that because I work inside and it's like, oh, what I do is really awesome. Haven't you heard about Magic the Gathering? But, you know, it's... I really think like Innistrad and Return to Ravnica were both huge home runs, and it was the fusion of world, design, and development that all made those awesome.
Now,
and I think with Theros, you guys will be excited too.
Now, were those things that, was that fusion not there for sets before Innistrad? Like, what do you think made those two stand out so much compared to other sets?
It was a slightly different philosophy, and something that Rosewater really felt strongly about, and some other people felt strongly about, is it used to be that we made sets around a theme, around like a mechanical theme. So you would go to, I don't know, let's say, what's an old set? You would go to...
Kamigawa?
Kamigawa is a fine example. I'll use Odyssey. Are you familiar with the Odyssey?
A little bit, yeah. Title?
Okay, so Odyssey was the graveyard set. Mm-hmm. So there are all these mechanics that cared about the graveyard. But the storyline was about... nothing that had to do with graveyards at all. It was like you're in this weird part of Dominaria where there's like squid creatures and there's pit fighters. Nothing makes any sense. Like there's a graveyard theme, but to go along with it, there's this weird world that doesn't make any sense. So it used to be that they were kind of made slightly away from each other a little bit.
Okay.
And that we made this mechanical theme very important. But we kind of changed our philosophy a little bit, I believe starting with Zendikar, where we're like, let's create a world. And we'll fill it with things that make sense. And we'll layer mechanics on top of that. But, like, Zendikar was adventure world. And so, well, it was a land world. Mark wanted to make a land set. But then we kind of layered adventure world in it. And so we had this great fusion where adventuring and lands, those two themes were kind of working together to create this awesome product. Mm-hmm. And Zendikar was kind of a first draft of this. And you really see it start to hit a home run by the time you get to Innistrad.
Okay. So now...
does that make sense?
It does.
Cool.
So now...
there's a lot of words to basically say... yes.
No, I'm glad that you took me through that, because like I said, I didn't understand, and that was something I'm glad you clarified, because I would read some of the articles and be like, and then if you were to ask me, what did Mark Rosewater just say, I'd be like, so so now
I think there were some words.
So now I know. So when you're not actually on a team, because it sounds like a lot of this stuff is team-based, and for Gatecrash, you were certainly on the development team for it, which we can get into a little later. What are you doing with yourself when you're not specifically on a team for a set expansion?
So there's a lot of duties that I fill. I mean, one of the big ones is I work on both Magic sets and this other game we make called Kaijudo. Mm-hmm. So I'm also working on the Kaijudo team, trying to make new card mechanics and future sets for that game. Additionally, one of the big duties of anybody who does work on the Magic side is to play test enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we have what's called the Future League, where we take the standard format, you know, about a year away and play that. Funny story, here's an aside. Way back when, we used to have the Future League. This was many, many years ago, far before I got here. There was the Future League. And the Future League playtested things 6 months in advance. The problem, it turns out, is 6 months in the future is not long enough to actually fix anything if there's a problem. You just get to kind of look smart by playing with cards and being like, oh yeah, that's going to be broken in 6 months. But the Future League was then invented as we go another 6 months out, so we can actually change the cards as you're playing with them. Mm. So when you're playing the Future League, you're constantly, you know, your deck cards are constantly being tweaked. I've cast a card and had it changed on the stack before. It's like all this kind of stuff will happen, but it's all good because it helps us work out the kinks of the set so that the set ends up as a nice finished product.
Mm-hmm. So with that said, though, I do have to ask this. I'm not sure if you can really reveal that, but you're indicating that there's testing, and you do sort of fast forward to what Standard will be, you know, in 6 months or a year or whatever. How many things that we're experiencing right now did you guys predict like a year from now? Like, did you have any idea that Reanimator would be as obnoxious as it was, or did you have any idea that, you know, Hexproof would be as polarizing as it was? Like, how many of these things really, you know, were surprises to you, and how many were you able to quietly be like, we kind of saw that coming?
We have a lot of hits. Like, we had the Hexproof deck. We have had various Reanimator decks. Usually, one thing that we're really good at is identifying what cards are going to be strong and going to be played. We do miss every now and then, but we, for the most part, we know what cards are going to get played. It's just the exact contents might be a little different. For example, a lot of our Reanimator decks were like black, red, green, like Jund-based Reanimator.
Really?
Or black, red, white, as opposed to having the some of the other elements like the junk deck does. So it's not to say that we didn't try junk Reanimator, because we did, but just like we ended up going with a slightly different version. But the thing is, what you have to realize is there's only so many people in this building playtesting this, and there's millions of Magic players out there, you know, all working to crack the format. So, you know, we do the best job we can, and we get pretty close a lot of the time. But yeah, like the Ban Hexproof deck, we had basically, I mean, that exact kind of deck. I mean, maybe a couple cards were off, but we knew that was a thing that people could do. And we tried to create, you know, a couple answers here and there to things like that. We like to keep the formats interesting, and like to make sure that there's plenty of room for them to change, even when no sets change. So we like to have cards that will kind of trump each other so that the metagame will shift week in and week out, even though no new set is coming out.
Mm-hmm. Have there been any times where you've been surprised? Like, let's say something like the Aristocrat. So it has so many specific interactions to it and minute interactions. Is that something that you guys could have ever seen coming? Or has there been a specific card where you're like, uh-oh, this is kind of taking over and we didn't think it would?
Well, the Aristocrats is actually a great example, because we played with all those cards, like Thalgrenath Aristocrat, check. Boros Reckoner, check. Even like Cartel Aristocrat, check. Like, we played with all those. But in that exact combination, no. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had black-red decks, we had red-black decks, we had white-black decks. We even had a couple black-red-white decks, but they didn't really have all the synergies that deck had together. So we know how all the cards play together, but we don't necessarily know, but we didn't necessarily have that exact combination. And it turns out that exact combination is really brutal.
Yeah.
But as long as I still feel like we do a pretty good job identifying the cards, so we make sure that no really egregious cards slip through. It's, you know, when like a Jace the Mind Sculptor slips through and it's a base absurdly powerful card on its own, that there's a huge problem. Where like with Aristocrats, at least you're using all these tiny synergies together, and there are a couple ways you can break that up. Mm-hmm.
Moving away from the Aristocrats, though, I mean, were there any specific cards recently that you guys didn't anticipate being hits? Like, did you think Thrag Tusk would be as big as it was?
We knew Thrag Tusk would be good. We didn't quite know it would be as strong as it is. So we had it in a lot of our mid-range and aggressive decks, mm-hmm. but we didn't have it in as many of our control decks. So that's an area where we missed a couple times. For example, Squadron Hawk was a huge card a couple years ago in the Stoneforge decks. And we played, and from what I understand, I wasn't here back then. I was actually out playing there, beating people with Squadron Hawks. But from what I understand, it's like we played a lot of that in our aggro decks and our mid-range decks, but it never quite made the transition to control. Just like, oh, a 2-mana 1/1, like that's not the kind of card you would play in this deck. Mm-hmm. So we do a pretty good job knowing which cards are going to be close, which ones are going to be in range, and which cards are going to be for sure played. But sometimes, like I said, the exact archetypes get a little muddled. So we knew Thrag Tusk was a really good card. We just didn't have it in like the, you know, five-color control deck or the Bant, I guess the Bant control deck. I actually had a Bant control deck internally, but I was playing some other cards in that place. I had like a couple more Augur Boluses. I was playing a couple of Drog, Skull of Reapers for life gain. In retrospect, yeah, like Thrag Tusk is really good in that deck. It just never got in there in the playtesting. It was sideboarded a couple times, but never in the main deck. Mm-hmm.
Can you think of a card that you all were hoping would take off and it just didn't?
A card that we were hoping would take off. What we like to do a lot these days is make a lot of cards that are almost there, and then some of the almost there cards will hit. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you look at a lot of the guild leaders in the Return to Ravnica block. You know, like the Lazavs and the Lazav and Aurelia and Gerard and all those guys. We knew they were all at like a pretty high power level. Not insanely powerful, but pretty high. And we figured that some of them would hit, which they did, and some of them would miss. But we weren't exactly sure which ones, because they're all pretty close to playable.
Yeah.
So that's a good example of like a place where maybe, you know, we would have liked it if like one or two more of those would have hit. The only card I can really think that we thought would be a big hit and wasn't, and we loved it because it was super fun, was Night Vale Spectre, which is like a super fun card to play with because you get to steal your opponent's stuff.
Yeah.
What's better than that? But it didn't quite make the splash we were thinking of.
Well, there's still time. I mean, I think that's a return. That's a Gatecrash card, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, there's still time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. And, you know, I think that... All right, you'll have to edit out this dead air. I'm just trying to think about what I want to say.
I think that falls into the camp of there's a lot of cards that I can see in this current block that will be good when some of the competition leaves. For example, one of the cards that I love is Exava. I love her art. I love her mechanics.
Yeah.
But when you've got that four curve, like when you've got Hellrider, you've got Falcon Wrath Aristocrat, you've got the new Ogre Battle Driver, that's a lot of competition for one slot. So I think that when you take away some of those other four drops, Exava starts to look really good. But when you put her up against what's already out now, people aren't going to play her. And I see that being the case with other cards too, where, you know, when you don't have those other three drops, you know, I can see the Spectre maybe getting a little bit more attention. And the same goes with other cards. They just can't compete with the, you know, we're in that weird, somebody had a phrase for this summer, because you have every set available right now. And it's a really crazy window where anything is fair game because it's the most sets available in Standard. So
right.
The competition is just so fierce right now. But I think come October, we're going to see some cards really break out. And then that could be one of them, I believe.
Yep. I certainly agree that, you know, when Theros comes in, and Innistrad goes out, a lot of which, whenever the new big set comes in, right, there's so much changes. And I think you'll see that with Theros.
Yeah, so I think that's something we're looking forward to. So tell me a little bit about what it was like being on the development team for Gatecrash, because this seemed like it was a really big deal for you, Gavin. What was that like?
It was awesome. So, I mean, I hadn't been in the building for that long, maybe a month or so, and I got asked to be on the development team, which is really exciting. Because I loved Ravnica. Ravnica was one of my favorite sets, the original Ravnica. Mm-hmm. And coming in and being going to be a part of this was great. And it was interesting because by the time I was there, a lot was already determined. So we already knew what five yields we were going to have. And we had some of the mechanics down. Some of them, like Extort and Cypher, came in really late in the process. But the other three, I basically all locked down by the time I was added to the team. Mm-hmm. And it was a great, great opportunity. I got to play kind of the new guy role, but I had a lot of fresh, exciting new ideas, and that's always really important. You always want somebody on your team who can be the person to kind of chime in and be like, are you sure about that? Or what about this thing? Maybe that'll generate a cool idea. And even though I feel like I'm a way better developer now than I was back then, I came up with some ideas then, which were really cool and novel, and I had all this excitement from just coming to the company. I was able to kind of bring that to the team. It was also great because I got to work with a bunch of really smart people. I mean, you know, Dave Humphreys is the development manager who led Gatecrash, and it was great seeing how he leads the set as the guy who manages all of development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got to work with Zach Hill, who's insanely smart and talented. I got to work with Mark Purvis. So Purvis is a representative from another area of the company. He's from Brand, and it was cool to see what his take on the set as another kind of outside voice and also when thinking about the brand of the game. And Max McCall, a great friend of mine, also on the development team. Max and I went to college together, actually. It's kind of crazy. We ended up working in the same department. And it was great to be able to work with him. And it was cool to make your own cards. I got to say, the moment when you get your card back and you have it in your hands and you made it feels awesome. But my favorite moment is actually not that moment. It's when you make a card and the card's in internally and you've commissioned art for it. And the art starts coming back, and you're like, wow, these random words I wrote down in this file, an artist is making something. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. You know, like somewhere across the world, I don't know, some, what's an artist name? Greg Staples is drawing your piece of art. You're like, that's so cool. Someone's making an art piece that I could never draw in a million years based on something I wrote.
Now, one of the big ones you were responsible for was Obsidat, right?
Yeah, Obsidat was a card I made, and... yeah, there's a funny story behind that, actually. So we went through so many Ghost Council designs. It was crazy. Like, we wanted to get Ghost Council right, and we all had a lot of parameters. We wanted him to feel like the old Ghost Council, because that was a really popular card. And so we're in this hole-filling exercise, And that's where we all submit ideas and we all look over the ideas. Mm-hmm. And we all could submit three ideas, I think. And I had two ones that I liked. And I was thinking of a third one and I wrote down this text. And I was like, there's no way they'll go with that. That's too powerful. But I just didn't have any other ideas. So I just sent it. And then everyone loved it. And that's how Opposite Act came into existence. So when I made it, I was like, that's too powerful. There's no way. And it turns out the card is pretty powerful. But sometimes you make powerful cards, and you know the restrictive mana cost helps keep it in check a little bit.
I will say Obsidda has certainly made people rethink the kinds of removal that they pack. Like, for example, I know I've been running – I was running Jund for a while, and then I just started playing this Golgari Rock deck. And when Doomblade came out in M14, a lot of people were like, oh, my God, Doomblade. And I was like, it doesn't kill Obsidda, guys. and people were like, well, who's really playing Obsidda? Oh. Okay. And I actually have been using Victim of Night. So you've certainly made people – you've made people want to have instant removal, number one. And you've also made people consider whether or not that instant removal will be able to kill an Obsidda. So I'd like to think you've made a bit of an impact with that card.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's kind of the funny tweaking that we do. For example, Obsidda originally had 4 power, and we upped it to 5 for a bunch of reasons. But one of the reasons was so that Selesnya Charm could remove it. So it's just like, you know, it's tiny things like that that you don't necessarily think about lead into this really interesting environment. And yeah, I'm glad the Obsidda's being played so much. It's a card that I loved. And when Tom Martell was playing it in the what was that tournament that I can't remember? Pro 2
or
Gatecrash? Pro 2 or Gatecrash, yeah. You know, the one of the set we were just talking about, perhaps. I'm exhausted. When he won Pro Tour Gatecrash and he had that in his deck, and I saw him playing it, that was so cool. It's like, I made this thing that just won a Pro Tour. How awesome is that?
So you, when you were talking about, you know, joining the team for Gatecrash, you know, you sounded very confident, and you've always been confident for as long as I've known you. But when you joined the development team and when the ball actually started rolling, was there a time where you thought, maybe I'm in over my head, or maybe I can't do this, or was there ever a part where it just really hit you how, I would imagine it wasn't easy. So were there any challenges that you faced or anything like that being there?
Well, definitely. I think the hardest challenge is Magic R&D is full of insanely smart people. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the people in Magic R&D are used to being the smartest person in the room. And so everyone kind of has the smartest person in the room. It's like feeling that they're the smartest person in the room. But when everyone's insanely smart, and you know that, and only one of them can actually be the smartest person in the room, and so you know I'm very used to being very intelligent. I don't know about the smartest person in the room, but you know I'm used to carrying an intelligent cadence. But to work with all these insanely smart people, you can't help but feel a little out of your league to start, especially because you're brand new to this. And granted, I've done some development work on other things in the past, but to come into Wizards where you have greats like, you know, Eric Lauer and Zach Hill and Dave Humphreys and Aaron Forsyth and Mark Rosewater and all these guys working around you who are just total geniuses, it takes a little bit to get accustomed to. But I feel like, you know, when I was on that design team, I was like, when I was on the development team, I was like a fledgling developer. And now I'm still not a full developer, even. I'm still learning every single day, but I've come so far and it's cool to see that transition.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I did some research on you, and Mark Rosewater has said that he considers you part of the fifth generation of designers. And it was in Wikipedia, and there was a reference to the article in which he talked about this. And there were a lot of other really big names that were included in the fourth generation, third generation, and things like that. How does it feel to get a compliment like that, to be lumped in with all these great designers of Magic like that?
No, I mean, it feels awesome. You know, the first time that you appear in a Mark Rosewater article is talking about how you're a designer now. It's like, I just read that and I was like, oh, that's so cool. You're right. I am. I'm part of the team. I've wanted this for so long. And to clarify what those terms mean, the fifth generation of designers that he's talking about are the people who really got brought in for community contributions and for showing that they could be a part of this game week in and week out for writing articles and that kind of thing. And so like we talked about earlier, that's something I was really strong on. That's part of why I was brought in. So that's kind of the fifth generation though that we're looking at a little bit here. And I'm excited to be a part of it. We've, you know, hired some people recently who have been, who are also in that kind of category. And it's great to kind of have all these great minds working together because you have a lot of pro experience, you have a lot of writing experience, you have a lot of people who can think very intellectually about the game. And, man, it's just so awesome to go to work every day and be surrounded by so many smart people. Now, there are people around me who have, like, multiple PhDs, like, you know, it could be, like, saving the world from malaria or something. and we're all just making magic cards. It's like, that is insane to think about how much intelligence is being used to make magic cards. And I love it, being around smart people. It's always great to feel like you can learn something from somebody.
Does it ever really sink in that you're there and you're doing this? Because it sounds like, and I love that you feel this way, mind you, but, you know, one of the phrases I like to use is queening out. You're just like, oh my God, you're just, you know, it just sounds like everything that happens to you is so like, oh my God, you know, and, you know, do you ever wonder if you're going to get to that point where you're just, yeah, I work for Wizards. I'm a designer. Or do you think you're always going to have that little voice in your head that's like, I can't believe I work with these people and I'm doing this?
Well, I would definitely say that I'm a queen. I mean, a true story, not making this up. Last month, I drove up to Canada to see Taylor Swift play a concert. Like, that's how badly I wanted to see her. And she was coming to Seattle. And it was PAX weekend, and I was like, I'm probably one of 10 people that this overlap destroys. So I can't see her this weekend. So I've got to go up to Canada and see her when she comes there. And it's funny because I was going with my sister. And everyone's like, oh, that's so great. You're going along with your sister to the concert she wants to see. And I'm like, actually, no. Like, I bought the ticket. She's coming with me. Yeah. I mean, the kind of – I'm just a big teenage girl, really.
Gavin Verhey, I did not know that about you.
Oh, yeah, the music I listen to is pretty sporadic. Like Sarah Bareilles and Taylor Swift and Kelly Clarkson. I mean, they, you know, I have some more mature artists in there, too. But I don't know. I'm a sucker for a good romance song and a good country song. But, you know, I'll listen to other popular, like pop and rock or whatever. I have very eclectic music tastes. And now you know.
Yeah. I actually find Taylor to be relaxing too. I can't listen to really upbeat music when I'm at work because then I find that I start bopping in my chair and then my energy gets really high and then I have to get up out of my seat. So I have to listen to kind of mellower songs. So for example, I have Back to December on my playlist. I have Innocent. It'll just get the slower, mellow songs because if I just get too upbeat, then I just get no work done. And then I start opening lots of tabs and I'm looking at different sites and it's, you know, woo, and I'm bouncing off
suddenly
the walls.
You're on like TaylorSwiftFan.com and yeah, I've been there too. I know what it's like.
No, actually, I was referring to magic sites, but
it's always magic sites for me too. Have you listened to her live album? It's really good.
I haven't. No, like I said, it's I can't really commit to full albums, but I can do like individual singles. You know, I'm a bit of a commitment phobe when it comes to Swiftie. So
that's fair. You can't go all in. But yeah, I found that Spotify has changed my music listening habits. Also, it's going to ruin magic for a lot of you, so I apologize. But most things that I write and a lot of the cards I create are created while listening to this kind of music. So if you ever want to know how opposite that was created, I was probably listening to, like, You Belong With Me or something while I made it.
But that makes sense.
No, not making this up.
That makes sense that you're singing You Belong With Me because you made Obsidot. So, you know, so you're sitting there, you're looking at the frame and you're just like, you know, you're doing your thing and that's your baby. That's what you're singing it to.
Yeah, totally. It's funny. If you look at my music history, it's so strange. It's like half these like pop songs and the other half will be like Mozart and Beethoven and whoever. And I'll be like listening to, you know, like For Elise. And I'm like, I'm kind of bored of this. Like, can we just get some upbeat music about like a relationship? That'd be great. So, yeah. And now you know.
We do. But I'm so grateful I got that side out of you.
A lot of things people know about me. That's probably one of them.
So when you look at that list of designers, though, that's featured in that article, like the fourth wave and the third wave.
About magic.
Yeah, we were. So, so what would you say that you've learned from these guys that came before you?
Oh, so much. I mean, I still learn things every single day. I don't anymore because we switched where everyone sat. But for about a year, I had the pleasure of sitting right next to Eric Lauer. And Eric is a complete genius. And it's funny because we're in opposite mental spaces because he's like a very math and number crunching oriented person. And I studied creative writing in college. So I'm like very much a writer. So it was cool to like learn so much from him about just, you know, the way he thinks. And I took some pieces that I liked. And I like that he at least learned a little from me as well. And he's just a total genius. I mean, you know, he could be doing something very different if he wanted to. But the fact that he's with us making magic cards is really fortunate. And when you see his name on a set, it's almost guaranteed to be good. I mean, he did Innistrad, which is phenomenal. And that was a time where he teamed up with Mark Rosewater. Mark Rosewater was the designer, and he was the developer. He did Return to Ravnica. So Eric has just keep hitting these home runs. Mm-hmm. Mark Rosewater is awesome to work with. He's just, once again, full of ideas, and he's extraordinarily passionate. It's great to feel that kind of passion in somebody else. Aaron Forsyth is incredible. He's hilarious. He's not afraid to speak his mind, and he's like the dad that everyone kind of needs in the pit. You know, it's wonderful to have him around. And there's just so many great minds. I mean, everyone here is my friend. You know, we all go out to lunch almost every day, and not all together. We're like split in different groups, and it's always cool to hear what everyone's been up to. And yeah, it's great fun. I love learning from everyone around me. It's a great experience.
I was gonna say, I would imagine it'd be hard for you all to find a table if you all went out at once. Like table for 27.
Right. Yeah, it's all through 27. All right, here's a question for you, Aaron. All right, this is stump Aaron.
Uh oh. Okay.
How many people do you think work at Wizards of the Coast?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to say it's probably less than people imagine. Do I get a hint? Like triple digits, double digits?
Nope, no hints.
Oh, my. Okay, so we're going the whole shebang. We're not talking, we're talking Helene, Mark, the big names.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to go for a shebang, it might as well be the whole.
Okay. I'm going to say 150.
Okay. I think it's closer to 400.
Okay, see, I was thinking 350, but I was thinking too big.
But you know, of course, R&D is a very small segment of that. We have people who work on the art, people who work on creative, people who work upstairs in legal and brand, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Brand is with that Tifa character, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We don't discuss her on this show.
Do you know that me and Tifa went to college together?
I didn't know that, actually. I have a lot of love for Tifa. I jokingly have this like alternate personality. Like, I'm convinced she's secretly a diva and nobody knows it, so I call her Diva Mayan. So it's a fun little thing between us, right? You know, because she's so sweet and you can't be mad at her for anything. And I'm just convinced there's like this dark side that nobody knows about. And so when people ask me what it was like to have her on my show, it's like, well, you know, she wanted the sound a certain way, and she only wanted orange Skittles, and her Evian had to be
in a white room.
Right? I mean, total. You guys don't understand. You don't know what she's capable of. I'm warning you.
Well, and as you all learned today on the podcast, I too am a diva. But just the kind of music I listen to.
God, something about you WotC folks, I didn't know. So what would you want people to learn from you, though? Like, let's say we're getting down to like the seventh, you know, wave of designers or whatever, and somebody else is looking back and going, Gavin Verhey, you know, what would you want someone to say that they learned from you?
I think something that I'm really good at, and this is because of how I was raised and how I think, is taking a lot of very disparate things and very quickly finding ways to connect them and internalize them and create kind of a structure out of them. And so, for example, like I said earlier, I have my fingers in a lot of pies and toes in a lot of pies. And so I've done work on Magic, Kaijudo, I've done a little bit of D&D work, I've done work up in Brand, I used to be a pro player, I was level 2 judge. I have all this experience in the Magic world. I used to write articles, I still write articles, right? I still do the daily MTG podcast every now and then. And so I have this wide range of experience. And I feel like I can connect all that together to use different talents for different things. So like, I'll be down in R&D and I'll be like, okay, well, this is a great idea, but what would Brand think of this? Or I'll be in a Brand meeting and maybe I'll be like, well, you know, that idea is really good. I mean, we were talking about this thing in R&D the other day, which would totally work with what you're talking about. So I can kind of connect things together. And I can also internalize and come up with answers really fast. I'm good at processing information, I guess. So if I see a string of things, I can kind of figure out how to connect all the dots. And when you're making a Magic set, it's really important because it goes through so many iterations and you have so many test points to figure out that it's important that after, you know, 3 or 4 playtests, you can see the patterns appear. You can see what's happened. And it's that kind of thing that I feel like I'm reasonable at, and also that working with Eric and staying next to Eric helped out a lot with, because he's a numbers guy, I'm a feeling guy, and I think when you combine feeling and numbers, you end up with a really awesome result.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to talk about your column a little bit, Gavin, because that's actually what got me interested in you and how I heard about you in the first place. So from what I understand...
All the ladies tell me that.
Oh, my. Okay, so from what I understand, you started off in charge of what was called the Daily Dex column, and you did that for a while, and then you moved on to what was now called Reconstructed. So how did that come about? How did you go from one to the other?
Well, it was kind of interesting. an interesting situation. So a truism about wizards is you'll do whatever you're good at, in the sense that if you're good at something, people will give you tasks to do that fit in that category, which I guess makes sense, right?
Sure.
So I came into Wizards, and I was there. It was actually maybe on my first day I was given this task to do daily decks. Kelly Diggs, who was the editor, turned to me and was like, hey, we need someone to do this. You're the guy for it because you have writing experience. And I had a lot of writing experience, right? I wrote those columns for so long.
Sure.
And he knew that I studied writing. So he was like, you should totally do this. And everyone knows I love writing. I mean, I made it very public that I love writing my articles and I love writing my Star City column. And I've just always loved writing. I've been writing since I was like 3 or 4 years old. In fact, I'll tell a quick aside. When I was 4, I couldn't really write yet. So instead, I would go to my mom and tell her stories, and she would write them down for me. And I still have them somewhere, back home where my mom lives, because I just always love creating stories that much. So I started off with the Daily Dex column, and that kind of grew over time. And then eventually, Patrick Jarrett, Trick Jarrett, got hired on as the new editor. And him and I are friends, and he also really loved my writing style. And so when he was looking at ways to revamp the website, he wanted me to have a column on there somewhere, especially after seeing that I'd done such good work on Daily Dex and all my Star City work. So he made it happen. We talked for a while about what kind of thing I'd like to write. He had me write a feature article, and then I had my own column. And it was really cool for me because, unlike a lot of other columns where you take something over, with Reconstructed, I got to build it from scratch. So he told me what he wanted it to be, which was like a deck-focused column where I took in readers' decks, and the rest was up to me. And over the past, I guess, over a year now that I've been writing this column, I've kind of figured out what works and what doesn't, and I'm constantly trying new things. And it's great to have that kind of originality built up and be able to try all kinds of interesting stuff out there.
Mm-hmm. So how has doing that column affected your opinions on rogue decking? Because it sounds like your column, one of the things I really love about your column is you build decks that are a little bit left of center, which I love, but you also give people a chance to have their ideas, you know, be published on the mothership. And even the ones you don't choose to work on, you still will leave a list at the bottom. And I really feel like it inspires people to go the more rogue decking route, because I do feel like there has been sort of a push for people to net deck, or people feel like they can only get ahead by net decking. And I feel like your column is one of the few that inspires people to do the opposite. Do you feel the same from doing the column, or did you always feel that way?
It's always kind of been a part of me, and I think maybe the column self-reinforced that a little bit, but I've always loved rogue decks. Now, don't get me wrong, when I was playing on the Pro Tour, like, I would play whatever one. I played, you know, Fairies. I qualified for the Pro Tour with Fairies. I qualified for the Pro Tour with Stoneforge Mystic, Jace deck, Kago. But also, like, I qualified for one Pro Tour by playing a deck in Extended with, like, Ninjas and Abyssal Persecutor and, like, stuff that was totally out of left field. And I feel like a lot of, like, if there's a best deck, like, I can't blame you for playing it, but a lot of people just don't innovate, and they don't take the time to work on a bunch of new things. And that's why when someone is a rogue builder, I really appreciate what they do. And kind of I got to work with some great people who are awesome rogue deck builders. For example, Conley Woods is a good friend of mine. And we've roomed together a couple times. We worked on decks a couple times. We tested our Pro Tour together. And seeing his process really allowed me to improve my process as a rogue deck builder. And I really grew an affinity for this. And then with this column, I've really had a chance to hone it even more, because every week I'm looking at something and I'm pouring through, you know, hundreds of emails every week from readers, finding what I think are like the coolest, most exciting decks and how we could tweak them to fight the metagame. And it goes to show you that there just are a lot of good options out there. Now, not every deck is perfect, and sometimes it is right to play the best deck, but there are also other options you can look at.
I definitely, my opinion on that has changed a little bit since I came back to the game and since I started doing more competitive events. And I feel like, you know, I feel like there's more of an opportunity for rogue decks than there was before. I think that there's different, you definitely have to work harder at it. You know, you don't have the community of people. Like, let's say you decide to play Jund, and you can go to a Jund forum and ask people for sideboard suggestions, and there are dozens of people who can give you feedback on it. If you want to play something like Kibler Ooze, which is something of more of a rogue deck, you're not going to have as many people to collaborate with. So you are more on your own with a rogue deck. But one of the things I'm always surprised about is, you know, when you watch Star City coverage, you know, you're always really, there's always these decks where you're like, why? Lobber Crew? Like, what's, okay. And someone will do something crazy with it, or somebody will do black-white zombies. And it's one of the things I really like. And even when I was at the TCG Open this past weekend, you know, there was somebody doing the big red build, which was the four Chandra's Phoenix, the four Reckoners, or whatever. whatever. And I've learned not to rule rogue decks out. And I think that the road's a little bumpier. But I truly believe that a rogue deck can do good things. And it still bothers me that a lot of people don't think that. And
well, that kind of goes back a little bit to what I was talking about earlier with putting a lot of cards that are all pretty close to playable, where that really helps out rogue decks, because there are a couple cards that are sitting just beneath the surface that are really strong, mm-hmm. and if you just build the right kind of deck for them, they can be quite good. And maybe they're just slightly less consistent than something else. Maybe that's why people don't play them, but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad, and you can figure out ways to make them good. Especially with Magic Online and all the tournaments that happen. There's so many Magic tournaments that happen today compared to even just 4 or 5 years ago. It's crazy how many events are happening now. The format just evolves so quickly, and the best decks get churned out pretty fast. And sometimes people, A, aren't looking for other options, but B, like they just don't have time to innovate them. Like, you know, if you go to a Grand Prix, it's like, well, crap, I don't have time to work on something new. I got to figure out what I'm playing in this tournament. And so it's really easy to fall into the same trends. And plus, when you do come up with a really awesome rogue deck, because of how information travels these days, it's no longer a rogue deck in 3 days. Mm-hmm. You know, you play it at a Grand Prix, it wins, and now it's everywhere on Magic Online.
Yeah.
So it's tough to break out of. But I think there's a ton of room for rogue decks, and I always try and come up with some in my column. And some of them have worked out really cool. And I get a lot of stories from people who email me after the fact and are like, hey, I took your deck and played it in some PTQs. This is what happened. And it's always fun to hear from those guys.
Yeah, it does feel like, if for some reason, it feels like there's a lot more innovation happening in Magic Online than there is on paper. I don't know why that is, but I love seeing these metagame reports that people toss out there. And it seems like a lot of the rogue decks, like I know Black-Green that I'm playing right now, the mid-range, got its start on Magic Online. Like, that's really where it got started. And then when it started being successful there, people started carrying it over into paper. And I wonder why that is. Like, I wonder what it is about the setting of Magic Online that makes people be more creative there than on paper. Do you think you might know why that is?
Well, I think a big reason, I don't know if Magic Online is necessarily more creative than paper, but it's certainly easier to have more, I mean, there's events happening all the time, so, and there's all kinds of daily events happening, so it's easier to play in a daily event with your brand new deck and you go 3-1 and have it published or something.
Okay.
I think that on the whole, a lot of online decks, you know, people are playing to win because they want to, you know, get their more booster packs, but there's so many events happening that it's easy for a rogue deck to go like 3-1 in a daily, and suddenly it shows up. And someone's like, that's an awesome rogue deck, I'm going to copy it. And it just expands outward. Also, I find that Magic Online tends to move faster than the real world. A metric that I think Jonathan Sawney, who was a former pro player, doesn't really play much anymore, said once is Magic Online is about 3 weeks ahead of the real world metagame. So often you'll see stuff show up on Magic Online, and you're like, oh, that's a cool rogue deck. And then a few weeks later, it's everywhere in tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
So because you can play so much Magic, you're just ahead of the curve a little bit. And, you know, you can try out new decks really fast. You can just hop in a tournament at any time and try out your deck, which, you know, certainly goes a long way toward improving decks.
Mm-hmm. And that certainly made Magic Online more attractive to me. I love that. I love that I can go in a daily and just be like, you know, there's that part of you where you're like half horrified and half amused. Where you're like, what is this elf ball? And why is there a Garrick on turn 4? Oh, shoot, there's a World Spine Worm on turn 6. Like, you know, it's
right.
You're just like, you're, on the one hand, you're really happy for somebody. Like, that's really cool. And on the other hand, you're like, I have nothing to sideboard against this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, I love watching people play games on Magic Online. Like, one of my favorite things to do when I have extra time is just go log on, go to the tournament practice room, and just like open up 6 different games,
mm-hmm.
and just watch all of them as they're going on. It's like what kind of crazy decks people are playing with, especially in Modern. I mean, like a huge fan of Modern, and I always love seeing what kind of concoctions people have come up with, what crazy old cards are bringing out, you know, whether it's like Talwisp and newer spirits. Like I even wrote about this one deck that someone sent me that was really cool, which was like this Blister Coil weird combo deck. Like, I love seeing those kind of challenges because they're so weird and unique, and there's so much you can do in Modern because of this large card pool. There are all these cross-block synergies that are just fun to try out.
Mm-hmm. So one of the final things I want to ask you, Gavin, and we did touch on this a little bit, but when I had Michael Robles on my show, we talked about, you know, one of the things I learned working in a customer service-oriented business is that an unhappy customer is an opportunity to wow them and to win them back to your side. And so how much does player feedback, like when you, let's say you go on Salvation, or let's say, for example, this weekend when we were watching the World Cup feedback or the Twitter feed and everybody was so polarized against Hexproof, and you see people that are just so against something, and you're seeing feedback like that. How much does that play into what you do? Like when you're making future cards or future sets, do you think of things like that? And if so, how much do you think of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We're constantly looking at stuff like that. It's kind of weird. I kind of relate in some ways working at Wizards to being a time traveler. Because right now, I'm working really far in the future. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not in your world. I'm in the future. But, right, they're flying cars. But in your world, what you're doing is affecting my future world. Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, maybe some, like, completely theoretically, right? Like, maybe Hexproof breaks out and word that's going to be really good going forward. So, we're like, all right, we have to, like, change our world, like, help, you know, do something about this world. And it's just really unique how what's happening in the real world impacts what we're working on right now. I've definitely had times where we've come to meetings and been like, all right, this deck was really good last week, and we have to make sure that it's not too strong. Like, can we tweak these cards? So what you guys are doing out there in tournaments is constantly affecting what we're doing in here. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to see that kind of relationship unfold. I love it. I mean, I make the time travel analogy because I'm a huge time travel fan. I'm a sucker for basically anything with time travel in it, even really bad things. Whenever there's like the time travel episode of that sitcom, it's like, all right, I'm on that. Everybody loves Raymond, where Raymond goes back to meet the dinosaurs. Sign me up. Like, I am in. And now I really want to see that episode. I wish that was real.
Did you read The Time Traveler's Wife?
I did not. I did not read the book. I wasn't going to see the movie, but a bunch of my friends warned me off of it, so I didn't.
No, the movie was very Hollywooded up. The book is excellent. Seriously, it's okay. A great, great read.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah. Even things like, I don't know, like, I saw Looper, and I was like, Looper was an okay movie. But just the fact that there was time travel involved just made me instantly more excited about it.
So does that mean we can look forward to going back to, like, Time Spiral or anything like that?
Well, I mean, this plays into everything. I love Time Spiral. It's my favorite block, probably. Now, the thing about Time Spiral wasn't great for our franchise – or, sorry, it wasn't great for our brand new players. It was so confusing. There's all this crazy nonsense going on. You would think that just didn't make sense. I mean, Aaron Forsythe loves to use this example of, like, how cards are stapled together to create other cards. And you have things that, like, not even people inside the building get are jokes. Mm-hmm. You know, like a Cyclopean Giant. It's a 2BB 4/2. And when it dies, it turns a land into a swamp permanently. And it's like, that's a really weird card. If I'm a new player, I don't get what's going on here. And as an enfranchised player, the joke is that it's Cyclopean Tomb plus two Cyclopean Cyclopses or Cyclopean Mummies or whatever it is. It's like, that's so strange. Like, no, like, it appeals to people. Like, such a small segment of people. But I love that kind of stuff. I love, like, when Magic reaches into its history and shows off all the stuff that I love. I recognize that it wasn't the best for bringing new players into the game, but I will always love that block. There are references that even now sometimes I'll draft it every now and then with my friends, and I'll get something cool, and I'll see a reference that maybe I didn't get before, or read a piece of flavor text that's commenting on something else that I think is awesome. So, I love time traveling. I love Time Spiral, I guess, as a corollary.
Tenacious Dead, is that you're doing?
What was that?
Tenacious Dead, is that you're doing?
Tenacious Dead? You mean Tenacious D?
Isn't that the new skeleton?
Yeah, Tenacious D.
Yeah. No, there's those skeleton folks from M14. They keep coming back.
Yeah, Tenacious D.
I know.
I mean, the card name is Tenacious Dead, but you got it. Let's be real.
Is that you're doing?
Oh, no. Does that have to do with time travel?
Well, you just mentioned, like, the inside jokes and things like that, and I just assumed that, you know, you were the funniest guy on staff, and...
Well, I appreciate your assumption. I wish I was the funniest. Actually, true story. Well, I guess in as far as my own observations are true, but I feel like I've become a more funny person working here, because I get to work with people who are just really funny, like Matt Tabak, rules manager. That guy's hilarious. Matt Tabak is really funny. Bill Stark is a longtime friend of mine. He actually does stand-up comedy. And I got to work with Ryan Miller for a while. He doesn't work here anymore, unfortunately. He left. But he's done improv for like 7 or 8 years, maybe longer. It's great to work with all these guys. I feel like working here has not only made me a better developer or a better Magic player, but I've just got to learn so much about life and how people think of it. It's made me a smarter person. And maybe a funnier person. I don't know. You have to ask my friends. Maybe I just got more dumb. But I, I don't think that's true.
I just had a Ruben Bresser on my show, and we were talking about, you know, how difficult comedies can be sometimes. And I would think being around all those funny people, you'd have more critics, where it's like, you know, if they weren't all comedians, you know, they'd probably be more likely to laugh at what you say. But because they're funny, too, it'd be like, that wasn't funny, dude.
So how often – all right, this happens to me all the time. And I'm never sure what I should do. How often does someone tell do you tell a joke and everyone laughs? And you're like, that joke wasn't that good. Are they just like, you know, doing that because – does that happen to you all the time? Does that happen to me all the time?
No, I tend to get if anything, I have the opposite response where I think I didn't say something that great and it will get like favorited and retweeted. And I'll just be like, I was just angry or ranting. And people seem to find me really amusing when I'm angry. Like I have my tilting.
Well, that's because you're adorable when you're angry. you're like, it's like trying to see an angry panda. Just gonna like flop around and eat like some eucalyptus or something, like go bathe in a river. And it's so angry, but it's adorable at the same time.
I don't know. I mean, I've been definitely dealing with my tilting issues, and I had tilted a little bit at this last TCG event that I was at. And this one guy was laughing at me, and he's like, I'm not laughing at you. He's like, I'm laughing with you. He's like, I just want to record you going off on these people. And I wasn't saying it to their faces, but, you know, I was with my friends, and I was like, oh, this guy played this deck, and he could just do this. I don't care. And he's like, I just want to watch you be angry. He's like, you are hilarious. So I've been told that I'm funny when I'm angry. I don't know if I'm funny when I'm not, but I guess that's sort of my niche comedy is I'm better when I'm bad.
Note to self, tilt
Aaron. I'm like a soda bottle. You just shake me up a little bit, point me at someone, and I'll just spew anger all over them. So
do you find that you tilt a lot?
I wouldn't say a lot, but it's there. And I'm definitely very aware of my tilt. Like I'm not somebody who just goes into blind rages, or I'm not somebody who just does things. I know why it's there. I have a very intimate relationship with my tilt. I've watched it sort of evolve in terms of like why it happens and things like that. I just don't know how to stop it. So like today I had a little bit of a breakthrough as to why I think it happens and things like that. And, I'm very aware of why it happens. I know when I'm doing it, I feel terrible after I do it. But if you were to ask me to rein it in or to somehow control it, I don't quite know how to attack it yet. So, that's my main issue right now, is I really need to work on that, 'cause it does bother me. I'm not happy when I do it. I'm not proud when I do it. But I just don't know what to do about it. So,
it's interesting to me because I feel like, and this is going to sound like maybe a really strange thing to a lot of people out there, but I feel like becoming better at magic and the skills that magic brings with it also really helped me out in life a lot.
How so?
Because like with tilt, for example, like I know a lot of people who tilt and about tiny things. I mean, they don't use the word tilt because they don't know the gamer lingo, but they'll get really angry about stuff. It's kind of irrational. And, you know, I feel like, when you play so much magic and you get good at controlling your tilt in a game, you can kind of take that the rest of your life and be like, you know, someone just cut in front of me in the grocery line. You know, I'm not going to tilt about it. Like, I can control myself a little bit there. It was a kind of other thing, like with pressure. Because I was playing pro magic at the same time I was in college. What would happen a lot is I would be playing these tournaments with a lot on the line, and I would, you know, maybe lose, maybe win, whatever. Then by the time I went back to college to take a test, like, that was nothing. It's like, yeah, like, taking a test is easy. In an hour, yeah, you know, like, I have no pressure here. I just played a match of magic with $1,000 on the line in the Grand Prix, right? And I feel like that kind of dealing with pressure and dealing with tilt and you know, knowing how to interact with people in a sportsmanlike setting are all things that have put into my life and have been really useful.
And it sounds like you're saying you wouldn't have learned those things if you weren't working for Wizards and doing what you do now?
Well, I don't know about working for Wizards, but at least playing Magic at a high level, I felt like that was really useful to me. I mean, once again, there's no way for me to know. Like, I don't know, maybe alternate universe Gavin is the president. but it's hard to know the road not traveled. You know, I wrote about this in my article that just came out last week. But with most decisions in my life, I'm really good. I guess something else that I'm good at is kind of predicting where things will go. And for most decisions in my life, I can look back and see this like murky backdrop, and I can see like kind of what would go if I went down the other path, right? I know the path I went down, and the other way, it's like, oh, what would happen if I went down this way? I can see kind of the like relationship I didn't have, or the passion that I never had, or the job that that could have been or whatever. And I can kind of see how that all works out. But with magic, that's the one thing where I honestly have no idea what I would be like today if I never started playing magic. It's become such a fundamental part of me. That it's just helped craft who I am today, and not just the game, but the people that I met through the game. I mean, a lot of my friends are through Magic, not all of them. I mean, I have a lot of non-Magic friends, people I met in college, a lot of good friends that I've met at conventions. But I mean, just like the people and a lot of the skills I've learned are so much through Magic. Maybe I'd be a biker right now if I wasn't playing Magic. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with bikers, but just, I'd be a very different person.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like I said, it could be the president.
I don't know how I feel about that, Gavin Verhey, to be honest with you.
Me as the president?
Yeah.
Well, my first rule would be no mana left behind.
So affirmative action, can I respond to an affirmative action? Like,
do you have priority?
I don't know. I'm assuming against the president, I wouldn't, but...
Yeah, it's pretty hard to... Yeah, it can't be countered, sorry.
And this is why I fear you as president. So, Gavin Verhey, if anybody has enjoyed listening to you today, where can they find you? How can they get in touch with you?
Well, you can find me at my home address.
I've tried. You're never there.
No, but seriously, if you want to contact me, I'm always up to chat. I love talking with people who want to talk to me about magic, as I've made pretty evident over this past... Oh, how long is this? About an hour?
An hour.
Over this past hour-long fire chat, or whatever you want to call it, fireside chat with Gavin. Yeah, that's how words work. Anyway,
was that a redhead joke?
No,
you said fireside.
Never. But yeah, I always love talking with people about magic, and you feel free to hit me up. The easiest way is probably on Twitter, at Gavin Verhey, just my name, no space in the middle. It's very original, but it gets the job done. Be happy to talk with you there. If you want to add me on Facebook, you're welcome to do that too. I look forward to talking with everyone out there in the future. I hope you guys like magic, and I hope you guys are enjoying the work we're doing and you're finding ways to help magic make you a better person.
Well, I know I certainly am, and I've definitely taken some of the things you said today to heart, and I definitely feel like it was worth it having you on, and I look forward to seeing you at Gen Con, and I think I'm going to be a lot smarter about Gen Con this year. I think it's going to be 30% socializing and 70%, no, I have that backwards again. I think it's going to be 70% socializing this year and 30% events. So I plan on keeping a lot of days open, Gavin Verhey. So if you need a cleric, or if you just want to kiki somewhere or queen out with someone, we can do that.
We can rock out to Taylor Swift together. it's funny. You mentioned the socializing thing. It's like, this is a great example, right? It's like a year ago, we had no idea who each other were. But because of magic, we're brought in by this unified language. We just talk to each other about this thing that we both love, two strangers from across the country. I mean, how crazy is that? I went to London over the winter, and I stayed. I was there for 10 days, and almost every night I stayed with a different person. And they're all people that I knew through magic. And it's just like, I know people across the world, tons of them, who will invite me into their house and like we'll hang out and we have a great time together. Who can say that about anything, right? I mean, like, it's very hard to say that about a lot of hobbies. And magic is just one that's so universal. It's like a universal language. I'll never forget the time that my mom walked into a Grand Prix hall, because when I was a kid, I would go to Grand Prix, and she would want to come along because I was a kid. And she and I got into trouble. I mean, never, but I could have, I guess. Anyway, she watched and she's like, there's so many languages being spoken here. That's crazy. You know, she really, really realized how universal it was. It's so crazy to me that all over the world people play this game and we help make it.
Yeah, it's a great feeling. And like I said, I played World of Warcraft for a long time. And it's like, I hesitate to say that the people I met through that game weren't friends. And I believe that you could be friends with somebody online, or the phrase internet friends. Like, I definitely think that's possible. But I have to say, one of the things that I think makes me enjoy Magic so much more is that I feel like I get to actually see these people. Like, I met so many awesome people through World of Warcraft that I never got to meet, either because we didn't go to BlizzCon or we just were never in proximity to each other. But, you know, with Magic, it just feels so much more real. And it feels like, you know, the opportunities to see each other, there's more of them. And it doesn't feel... I don't feel the sense of regret that I feel when I think of my WoW friends, because there are so many people that I wish I could have met, but I had no real incentive to go see them, where to see them just for them, I don't want to say they weren't enough, but it helps if there's an event in the area where you're like, hey, there's a magic event in the area. We're friends online. You've got a couch I can crash on. Two birds with one stone, go. Or Gen Con. You know, there's Gen Con and PAX and all the other events that Magic is featured at. You know, there's just more opportunities to see people, and it just feels more real. It feels more tangible. And I just don't have that sense of regret like I did with WoW, where, you know, with Magic, I can barely keep up with the people that I'm meeting. You know, and the list of people that I want to meet is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Whereas with WoW, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it just felt very bittersweet to be friends with these people, because it was like, God, we're friends and we share, but I'm never going to meet you. And that's just kind of, I can't take my mind off of that. And I don't feel that with Magic. And I feel quite the opposite, where it's, you know, it's a good problem to have. You're like, I can't squeeze all these people in. And like, I really do love that feeling as well. So.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. I'll look at my friends list on Facebook or something. And people ask me, how'd you meet that person? I'd say at a tournament. And they're like, which one? I'm like, gosh, I have no idea. I mean, it's weird. I mean, maybe you've experienced this too. But it's not really like you meet someone at any given point in time. It's just like they slowly work their way into your life almost, right? It's like you see them at events over and over, and you play them once or twice, and suddenly they're your friend, and you're going out to dinner together. Do you experience that also?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Awesome. Like, I went to a TCG, I went to a PTQ 2 weeks ago, and I didn't have a ride. My ride kind of flaked out on me, and I really, really wanted to go, but I had nobody else who was going. And one of my Twitter followers, who just started following me, said he was going. And I didn't really know the guy, I freely admit it. He seemed nice, you know, he looked safe. He said he was a vegan, I trusted him. You know, got to know him a little bit, and I actually gave his phone number to some of my friends, and I was like, if this guy skins me and turns me into deck protectors, you have his phone number. But I trust him, and I'm going to go for a ride with him. And we ended up having a really good time. He was really good people. He picked me up. I got there safe and sound. He was great to talk to throughout the event. We're still friends. We'd like to hang out again sometime. And, you know, if it were any other situation, my friends would be like, you're getting in a car with this guy for 2 hours that you don't know, what are you doing? But in this situation, it was different. People, we just didn't think of it like that. And I don't know, something about the game and the setting just made it more okay. And it turned out for the best. And then, like I said, if it were anything else, I would have probably never did it. But
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like Magic undid all my mom's years of hard work teaching me things. It's like, don't get in cars with strangers. Don't like take advice from people you don't know.
Don't make out with guys in boiler rooms at WMCQs. Oh, sorry, that's me. Just.
I am not commenting on that situation. Also, the boiler room? Really?
We couldn't help it. Somebody walked into the conference room. We had to go somewhere. Didn't you listen to Heavy Meta? I told this story on Heavy Meta.
I did not.
I was bad. Yeah.
I've been a bad boy. But you know, it is incredible that it's like, yeah, I'll like multiple times in my life, I have flown across the country to stay in the house of a person I have never met. Mm-hmm. And it's like that, if you just tell a human that, they'll kind of raise their eyebrows and be like, are you okay? Did you need any help? It's like, no, that's great. I do it all the time. It's really fun. And it's like, you know, how do you react to that? But I mean, something I'm really big into is, as a writer, I'm huge into stories and storytelling, and I love how everyone has a story. And so by staying with people and meeting people of all kinds, I feel like I've really been able to broaden my reach and learn so much and so hear so many different stories. It's crazy to me to think about, and maybe other people don't feel the same way I do. But when you walk down the street, let's just say you're walking down a city street, you'll pass by hundreds of people in the span of 10 or 15 minutes, maybe, if you're at a busy city. And every single one of those people has a life story. They've all grown up, they've all had friends, they've all been places that are great, they've all been had high highs and low lows, and people that they loved and cared about, and you know, maybe even people who have died. And every single person has had those kind of experiences, you know, and everyone is unique. And I wish I could just learn about all of them. So the opportunities to go do that, do something kind of crazy and meet somebody new and learn about them and hear their stories is great. And it's, of course, stories are our barter system, right? Like, I'll trade my stories for your stories. We'll sit there all night learning about each other. And that's phenomenal. I love that kind of experience.
Well, I'm definitely glad that I got to hear your story tonight. So thanks again for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure. I've been wanting to come on for a while, and I'm glad we could finally make it work.
Yes, of course. And if anybody has enjoyed what they've heard here, you can always find the Deck Tees on legitmtg.com. After that, you can find me on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Feel free to subscribe and leave me a positive review. If you have any feedback for me, you can always find me. What was so funny?
If you have any negative reviews, email them to gavinbrett@gmail.com.
Well, I'm just saying, is I tend to get a lot of really positive feedback on Twitter and things like that, but it means so much more when it's like a review, because iTunes will put you on the front page a lot more, you might chart a lot more, and there's...
I'll take the negative one. It's fine.
That's fine.
I'll revel in them.
It'll be like that Star Trek episode where that one guy was trying to use Deanna Troi as like his bad thought receptacle, and she just turned really, really old and crazy. You can just be really old and crazy, and I'll be all beautiful and positive. So.
Oh, right. Is that how this? Oh, that sounds great. I'm glad we came to this arrangement. So I used to do Monday Night Magic on this podcast for a while, like we talked about earlier, and before I was a host. I started on like episode 8 or 9 or 11 or somewhere in there, and I listened to the first couple episodes and I left a review that was like 2 stars. This podcast is okay. It probably won't survive within a couple episodes. And then I became a host. And then there we were 250 episodes later. So I guess it worked out okay. But I'll never forget that.
So as I was saying before my negative thought receptacle interrupted me, if you have any other feedback for me, you can always find me on Twitter at Original Astros. That's OriginalOestrus. Or you can reach out to me directly through email at astros@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.
I finally learned.